And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
The last few years, I have spoken at the White Coat Investor Conference on a virtual basis. And while it was great fun and had some good feedback, I knew if I ever had an opportunity to be there live and be part of the action, that it would be fun. And this year, fun it was. I absolutely had a ball. It started the first day of the conference. They had, I think, four or five of us that spoke for 2 hours each. And so I knew going in that I was up against some tough competition for these two-hour workshops. And so I had no idea of the 600 approximate participants, and many of them may not have shown up first thing in the morning on the first day of the conference. But we had somewhere between 150 and 200 people in the room. I could not see an empty chair, and it was absolutely a delight to speak to those folks. These are people, all of them, that follow the work on one of what we call the truth teller sites. And by the way, when I call some site a truth teller, like The Balance or Morningstar, I don't mean to suggest that every word that is written is the truth. But they are sites where the information that you get, I believe, is truly in your best interest. There are people who believe in dividend stocks and people who believe in very different asset allocations than what we suggest. But it doesn't change the fact that the work that they're doing is likely in the best interest of the people who follow that educational material. So I had a good bunch of students. I knew that they were aware that the term small cap value is important to me, and I get ribbed about that. But the fact is, there are so many people who say, put all your money in the S&P 500, even Warren Buffett. There are people who advocate only for the total market index. And I, from everything I know, I'm not critical of those asset classes. I just think that people should consider having some exposure, more than, for example, what you get in the total market index, which is almost meaningless when we look back at the return. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But I got a bunch of questions while I was at that conference, and it is my desire to respond to many of them. Others I'll wait for another day because they maybe are on topics that we're going to be developing in the coming months, and I want to wait until I have all the information. But I'm gonna focus on some of the very common questions I got at the conference. And the first one, in some ways, is the most interesting because it seems to confuse people. There is this, I'll call it a fork in the road, where you have people who are really supportive of great growth companies. I have friends who, one friend has most of his money in Tesla because he just sees that as being this amazing company over the decades to come. On the other hand, we talk a lot about value. And one of the pieces of information that's commonly shared is that value out of favor securities and stocks and whatnot, value companies historically as a group, not one by one, but as a group, produce a better rate of return than those growth companies as a group. So many times during the conference, that question was posed because it is so counterintuitive. And I really believe, as is the case in many of the questions I get, that the best answer should come from the source of the material. I am but a hardworking teacher. I am not an expert. I'm not a research a guy I simply have learned from what I consider to be some of the most trustworthy. And I thought it would be interesting to go to the internet, and I picked up some material from Dr. Fama and Dr. French, the two that developed this small cap value factor and small cap factor thinking in terms of helping to build a more productive portfolio. So let me read from a 1997 article entitled Rethinking Stock Returns, New Evidence on Value Versus Growth. Quoting here, investors generally subscribe to the conventional wisdom that growth stocks outperform value stocks. But a study of international portfolios by professors at the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business and the Yale School of Management have shown that in reality, the reverse is true. Value stocks reap higher returns than growth stocks in the markets around the world. Value versus growth. The international evidence. A 1997 working paper co-written by finance professor Eugene F. Fama of the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business and Kenneth R. French, a former Chicago faculty member now at the Yale School of Management, argues that the conventional wisdom is wrong. Speaking about growth stocks, Fama says, people think because these are good companies, their stock returns will be high. But in fact, their prices are pegged so high by the market that their returns actually tend to be low. And let me just stop for a second there and reflect on that. Because what it is that people see is they see the price of a great growth stock once it has become and is a great growth stock. But so often, once people see that growth for a period long enough and a story to go along with it, there's always got to be a story, that they then see the future looking like the past. Maybe not exactly like the past, because that would be too much to ask, but a lot like the past. Going on in the article, Fama and French define value stocks as those stocks that have high ratios of book value to market value, and growth stocks as those that have low ratios of book value to market value. Quote, the intuition is that value stocks have low prices relative to their book value, so the market feels they're relatively distressed, says Fama. The intuition is the opposite for growth stocks. And later in the article, Fama says, if you want to explain average stock returns, we find you need three measures of risk. Those measures are sensitivity to the market return and two other measures, a measure to distinguish the risks in small stocks versus big stocks, and a measure to distinguish the risks in value stocks versus growth stocks. In papers published since then, Fama and French have tested that theory to determine whether it holds up. We tested it first on U.S. stocks and found that the theory holds up pretty well in domestic portfolios. By the way, notice the term pretty well. Well, as anybody who knows what we've shared with you in the past about the dependability. This dependability is not something you're looking for in the short run. It really is a long-term perspective that you have to take. In this report, he goes on, we looked at international stocks. We looked at 13 countries, the U.S. among them, and found that, again, the theory worked well. The database allowed us to look only at big stocks, so we couldn't test the size measure, but the measure of value versus growth holds up. And I might just insert here that this article goes back a long time. Since then, they have been able to test this theory on small cap value stocks around the world, and it is held up in almost every country. And then just to finish this, it's a much longer article. In fact, we'll even include a link to that article. It talks about a second implication for investors is that value stocks have higher returns than growth stocks in markets around the world. Looking at book-to-market equity, Fama and French found that value stocks outperformed growth stocks in 12 of 13 developed countries from 1975 to 1995, and that the difference between average returns on global portfolios of high and low book-to-market stocks was 7.6% per year. Furthermore, when earnings to price, cash flow to price, and dividend price were examined, the value premium continued to be evident. In other words, there is more than one way to determine value. And in my education from Dimensional Funds, a fund family that uses Dr. Fama and French's work, and Dr. Fama and French are directly involved with DFA. What we learned, a couple of things that we learned is, first of all, you can go 20 years and growth will outperform value. So as I mentioned before, this is a matter of long-term performance. The reason that's important is because that period they tested could be a period that made value look very good. You could test other periods where value didn't look that good. But over a long period of time, there is a sizable premium. They are very quick to suggest that trying to pick these stocks individually is not a good thing to do, because the odds are that over a five-year period, half of the companies that were distressed at the beginning of the period are still distressed. And this premium is so high historically that you really should own them all, so that in a sense, if it works, you're guaranteed to receive that premium, which is one of the reasons that some managers of value stocks who try to pick the very best value companies don't do so well, because they have selected some that, in fact, didn't outperform. And the other part that I remember from my days of taking the classes from DFA about this topic is that, yes, there are many ways to define a value, like was mentioned, cash flow, PE ratio, this book to market, but what Fama and French found was that if you looked at the tax implications of using the book to market, that over a long period of time, while the return of the portfolio could be very similar to a PE approach or a cash flow approach, but that what happened over time was that if you looked at taxes, the book to market produced a better long-term return. And I've got to also mention, I think this is so important, you can build small cap value portfolios at least a dozen, maybe two dozen different ways that they're all theoretically legitimate. They could represent different organizations, ways of identifying what value is. But at the end of the day, my hope is that whichever one you decide you want to follow, that it be done at a very low cost, that it be done in a massively diversified way, and that is going to give you the highest probability of success. As those who follow our best-in-class recommendations know that we are big fans both of the Avantis ETFs as well as DFA. Here's another question. I have my retirement investments in a target date fund. how much small cap value should I add? Now, let me explain where this came from. I'm a great fan, particularly for people who don't want to do their own thing, to putting your money in a target date fund, and the probabilities of success, if you're a good saver, are very, very high. I'm also a big fan of trying to figure out, is there any way you could use target date funds and give yourself an opportunity for a higher rate of return with a hands-off kind of strategy, remembering that a target date fund, you don't have to do anything but pick the target date when you're going to retire. In fact, once you've done that, they know approximately theoretically how old you are, and they can continue to manage until the day you die. And I think you'll get a pretty good return. But if you want more, what we know is the weakness in the target date fund is they don't have very much small cap, and they don't have as much value, at least as we think, and we think that because people we respect think that. So the idea of tweaking the portfolio in a very simple way, for example, if you put 20% or 10% of the money you put into your target date fund, instead put it into small cap value. So if you're saving 10%, 9% goes into the target date fund, 1% goes into the small cap value fund. Don't even have to rebalance. I think it's okay if you just stay the course. Now, what's going to happen is, if you've done that for many, many years and it's performed well, you're probably going to feel it's okay to continue to not rebalance. On the other hand, if it has created a bumpy ride that's a little bit uncomfortable to you, you might want to rebalance on an annual basis. You are likely to make more if you don't rebalance, but either way is in fact legitimate. You can also use a wonderful strategy developed by Chris Pederson, the Two Funds for Life. And the Two Funds for Life, basically, one way is take your age, multiply that times 1.5. So if you're 40, that 1.5 would make the answer 60. That's how much you put into the target date fund and the balance you put into the small cap value. As you get older and older, the percentage in small cap value gets lower and lower. In fact, you're completely out of the small cap value by the time you're 66. And I'm just telling you from my experience that if you've had something work well for 20 or 30 or 40 years, you're not likely to give it up totally. And the work of Chris Pederson, the research that he's done, shows that even a 10% piece of small cap value is likely to give you the support to take a higher safe withdrawal rate, which is a big decision people make when they are in retirement. Now, if you want to learn about this stuff on the Two Funds for Life, and this is not my research, this is Chris Pederson, who is our foundation's director of research. He has a book, Two Funds for Life. We have a book, We're Talking Millions, 12 Simple Ways to Supercharge Your Retirement. Both of those books have, well, in his book, it's all about Two Funds for Life. In my book, it's about half of the book is about Two Funds for Life. They're both free. They're both free. If you go to paulmerriman.com/signup, you'll go to a place where you can choose either one of those books. And in fact, in the case of We're Talking Millions, it's also available as an audio file. I hope you find it useful. Okay, next question. It's a very similar question as the last one, but it's one that may be more to your liking because of how you think about investing. Maybe you don't want to buy a target date fund, but like many of you that I've met, you have all of your money in the total market index. And so then the question is, because I advocate for small cap value as a part of the portfolio, how much should I add to my total market index? Now, the beauty of the total market index is it is all equities. The target date fund, even for a 20-year-old, oftentimes has 10% in fixed income. And I'm not very happy about that because that's costing you money. Every 10% fixed income is going to cost you about a 0.5% compound rate of return. So let's say you're going from whatever age you are until you're 40 or 45 or 50 before you add any fixed income. Again, I think the answer is at least 10 to 20, but if you will just go, again, we're going to have a link here. If you go to our table B14A, it is a table that shows you every combination between the S&P 500, which is virtually exactly the same return as the total market index historically. You can look at it all in the S&P, 90%, 80, 70, all the way down to 100% small cap value. So you could see, for example, that over the last 52 years, the S&P 500 compounded at about 11, but the 50-50 small cap value and the S&P 500 compounded at closer to 12.7. So that's a substantial improvement. And here's the thing that I think is fascinating. If we looked at the worst 12-month experience, they both lost money. One lost 43%, that was the S&P 500. And the other, the 50% small cap value, lost about 46%. There was about a 3% difference in that worst 12 months. To take that kind of risk for the opportunity to pick up an extra 1.5 plus return, I think that's an easy, easy choice. And the next one, that would be a question that again ties into the rest of the conversation in a nice way, I think, is there were questions about what is that difference between the S&P 500 and the total market index. And I think one of the reasons people are questioning that statement of past returns is because so many people have made this claim that the total market index is going to give you more than the S&P 500. You know, that's the good news. There's potential there. But the reality is the S&P 500 over the last, and the academics have looked at both, going all the way back of over 90 years, there's about a 0.1% difference to the S&P 500. And if we looked at the last, let's say the last 10 years, and we looked at for example, the S&P 500 versus the total market index. The S&P 500, about 12.4. The total market index, I'm looking at the Vanguard total market index, 12. So there was about almost a 0.41% advantage there to the S&P 500. Now, how can this be? How can it be that their returns are so similar? Well, they're both cap-weighted. And the big companies have the biggest impact on what the return of that particular fund is going to be. And what they've got in this very small percentage, I think it's about 5% that's in small cap value, is in the total market index. So it has some, S&P 500 has none. Why wouldn't the total market index do better? Partly because that exposure to small cap has got a lot of small cap growth in there. And small cap growth has so underperformed that by adding kind of, let's say, equal amounts of growth and value, it was not enough to make a difference because small cap growth really has performed poorly long term, which kind of leads to an important question that you might be asking, and that is, you know, what return should we expect from these major equity asset classes? And I don't expect you to remember what I told you at the presentation, but let me tell you again. Going back to 1928, the S&P 500 at 10.2, large cap value 11.2, small cap value 13.4, small cap blend 12.1. Now, those are major differences, and what the academics will tell us over and over again is the reason for the differences is basically simply about a difference of risk. It's not surprising that another question that came up many times, because I talk so much about small cap value, was what small cap value do we recommend? Well, we have a number of different ways that we recommend mutual funds and exchange-traded funds. We've got portfolios that are purely Vanguard, purely Fidelity, purely Schwab. We also have one entitled the best-in-class ETFs. So in the best-in-class ETFs, we choose from all of the commission-free ETFs that are available at Fidelity, at Vanguard, and at Schwab. So you can be any of those places, and you can access these particular ETFs that we recommend. And so what Chris Pederson, here's Chris at some of his great work, he has gone through all of the ETFs in each asset class, and said, this is the one that I believe will perform amongst the very best. Nobody knows the future. There are reasons he believes that. And in fact, if you have a true interest in why he believes these particular ones are better, I would encourage you to go to paulmerriman.com and under portfolios, click on ETFs, and then you can go to some articles there by Chris Pederson and how he selects them. But let me just tell you quickly that if you were to look at Vanguard, you might end up in VBR or you might end up in SLYV. The difference, I think it would be great for you to see the difference. See the difference in the average size company. See the difference in the diversification. See the difference in expenses. See the difference in all of the factors. How deeply discounted? What is the book to market ratio? And so we do happen to pick SLYV instead of VBR for those people. But for the best in class, Chris has chosen AVUV. And for lots of good reasons. It does things that the Vanguard funds don't do. Specifically, it not only looks at the size, the diversification, but it also looks and how deeply discounted the value is, but it looks at the orientation to the quality of the companies inside the portfolio. There are a lot of people who believe that factor, along with the size, along with the value orientation, is important for the long term. And it certainly has been in recent markets. Another great question, what account, taxable, tax-deferred, tax-free, should I put the small cap value in? Now, I want to recommend a book. And I just think it is one of the finest books ever written on investing decisions. And I'm talking about the long list of questions that if I sat with you long enough, almost every one would be addressed in the book entitled Your Complete Guide to a Successful and Secure Retirement, the definitive resource for anyone planning for retirement, written by Larry Swedrow and Kevin Grogan. Now, Larry has been a hero of mine for 30 years or more, and he has penned many books. But this one, I think, does a remarkable job of addressing things like asset location, whether you should have gold or commodities or other kinds of investments in your portfolio, distributions, all sorts of different asset allocation questions, taxes, building, writing your own investment policy statement, getting how to get the family together to discuss these kinds of topics. It is a real winner. It is available as a paperback. And I'll tell you, the $14 or $15 you'll probably spend will be some of the best in your life. I just can't recommend it enough. And again, he is one of our truth tellers. So in the case of my granddaughter, our granddaughter, first granddaughter in the family, we've written about this and done podcasts about how to invest for the newborn children. That money that we gifted to our daughter, that is to be taken care of until our granddaughter can take the money that it grows to and put it into a Roth IRA. We want that to go in small cap value. We would like it to be all in small cap value. We would like it to be all in small cap value for the rest of her life. And it should, could grow to be worth many, many millions of dollars. And our investment was $10,000. Now, while I would like to put it all in small cap value, it certainly is not the most tax efficient asset class over the long term. Better as an ETF than a regular mutual fund, just because of the tax advantage of the ETF. But instead, we split it 50-50, S&P 500 and small cap value. And the reason we didn't put everything in that particular investment is because we want, when our granddaughter is 18 and she'll be able to understand what's happened to her with this initial investment and what it will be worth, my daughter will have kept track of the yearly progress of the small cap value and the S&P 500. But the S&P 500 is a great fund, better fund to hold inside of a taxable account, certainly than small cap value. But why not all small cap value? Well, because we know there are going to be long periods. In fact, unfortunately, based on what we know about the past, those first 18 years, she may find out that the S&P 500 did better than small cap value, because that's happened a number of 18-year periods before. So small cap value, I think, is excellent in a Roth, excellent in a 401k, and then you would find other equity asset classes like the S&P 500 more tax efficient in a taxable account. Another question: what do you think of an all equity portfolio, at least till retirement? And by the way, I've talked to a lot of people in my career that have all equity all the time, and they're older than I am. I wouldn't have the stomach for it, I think. In fact, I know that I wouldn't, because my wife and I are 50-50 stocks and bonds, and figure that exposes us to enough risk at our ages. But here's the interesting thing. If you look at the assumptions of how you might do in a target date fund, we've looked at the way that Vanguard creates their target date funds. And the expected rate of return is a little more than 8%. And an all equity portfolio over that period of time, now I'm thinking about an all equity S&P 500, would be around 10%. Now, if you invested $6,000 a year over a 40-year period, at 8% you'd have $1.7 million. At 10% you'd have $2.9 million. By the way, If you could figure out how to make 11, and we got lots of portfolios that are built to do that, they are partly S&P 500, but they have the other asset classes. At 11%, that portfolio would go to 3.9 million. And then at 12%, again, it's possible. I mean, that 50-50 S&P 500 small cap value has a 52-year track record of about 12.7. And did much better than the S&P last year, by the way, and in many years. But that would grow to 5.2 million. So the all equity portfolio, legitimately, that range is from 1.7 to 5.2. But here's the thing that we got to remember. If you do any of these for 39 years, okay, let's just assume 39 years, and in that last year, it is the year that the stock market goes down 50%. In fact, what I did was just out of curiosity, I said, okay, what was the worst year for small cap value or for those kinds of things that make 11% and for those kinds of things that make 12% and for the S&P 500? So if after 39 years, you had a big decline in that last year, instead of ending up with 1.6 million in your target date fund, you'd have 1.1. If you were at a 10% compound rate of return, you'd have 1.3. Yes, you would have gotten up to a big number, 2.6 million, but you could fall back to 1.3. Because a 50% decline is built into those stocks. Peter Lynch, Warren Buffett, other people have said, if you're not willing to lose half your money, you shouldn't be in the stock market. Same thing at 11%. It's a little bit more. It's a little bit more than at 10%, but you'd be down to about 1.6 million. Yeah, you'd be up to 3.5 after 39 years, but that last year you could go down to 1.6. And at the 12% compound rate of return, you would have been up to 4.6, but would likely, potentially, be down to 2.1 million. So this is the interesting thing about the all equity. You're setting yourself up, even if you have to face a large decline in that, in some point after which you've reached your goal. And that big decline will take you down a lot, but probably not down as far as the more conservative strategy would have over all of those years. When I was an advisor, I had a lot of people I talked to that were many years away from retirement, all equities. They had more money than they would need in retirement. And I said, are you willing to continue to take that risk, or would it be time now to convert your portfolio more to something that looks like what you would want at retirement with all of this money? And I won a lot of those arguments, and I lost a lot of those articles, because when somebody has done well with something for a long time, it is so hard to give up. Think of GE. Think of General Motors. The country that represented, as General Motors goes, so goes America. Oh, I can feel myself wearing out here. I want to do three more. I've got more after that, but I'm going to have to do them another day. And I love this question. I want to be fairly aggressive at age 38. What do-it-yourself target date fund equity asset allocation would you recommend, and what strategy would you suggest for adding bonds? Now, I want to break this question up here a little bit, make sure you understand what he's getting at, or she. First of all, target date funds are built so you don't do anything. They do it all. They determine at your age, number of years to retirement, how much you should have in equity, how much in fixed income. They determine how much you should have in U.S. stocks and international stocks and large companies and small companies. And I can tell you that almost all of them are driven in the equity portion by large cap blend, total market US, total market international. And then they'll have some bonds in there. And for many of you, I think about the white coat investor members being treated as conservatively as a typical target date fund is, how much more aggressive you would likely be. And I don't mean wildly, unreasonably aggressive, but just more aggressive based on all of the historical evidence that we have. So this person is saying, I want to build my own target date fund. I want to determine how much should be in equity and fixed income. And what equity am I going to put in the portfolio? And what fixed income I'm going to put in the portfolio? So the question then becomes, what asset allocation would I recommend? And how would I add the bonds? When and how much? Well, first of all, we have these different strategies, from the two-fund strategy of the S&P 500 and small cap value as the equity exposure. Or you could use the four fund strategy with large blend. This is all US, large value, small blend, small value. Or you could use the worldwide four fund strategy where it's 25% in the large cap US blend, 25% in international large cap value, 25% in international small cap blend, and 25% in U.S. small cap value. So you have both the diversification of the large and the small and the value and the growth, along with the exposure to U.S. and international. And I'm just going to tell you, if you look at table H1, you will see that the returns of all three of those portfolios are pretty simple. If you wanted to step up and do something that would be more aggressive, you might look at the worldwide all value or the all US value. That one happens to be half small value, half large value. And in H1, remember, this is about do it yourself, which means you are supposed to be responsible for knowing how much risk you're taking with these strategies. And we try to make it easy for you by building this table. And I just think that H1 table is a beauty. Daryl Ball's built that, and he'll be updating it in the next few weeks to include 2022. By the way, 2022 changed some things. It changed the compound rate of return from 1928 to 2022 to a considerable difference, about 0.3% a year because of what happened in 2022. So you're going to have to choose. Now, the fixed income portion, then it's a question of when do you start adding it. So you can start at 40, you could start at 45, you could start at 50. But let's say you start at 40 and that you want to be relatively aggressive and not load up with a whole bunch of fixed income too early. But by the time that you are 65, that you would like to have about 40% or 50% or 45 or 35, whatever, in fixed income. So you could put 6% in when you're 40. That's your first fixed income. And you do 6%, another increase in 45. So for the first 5 years, you're going to be at 6%, and then it's going to jump 6%, and then at 50, it's going to jump another 6%, and then at 65, you're going to, all these little jumps, and by the time you get to retirement, you are at that combination that you're happy with in retirement. Now, for some of us, myself included, I stayed committed to equities for a long time, and then went from being relatively aggressive to being 50-50 for the rest of my life. So when I started 50-50, when I was about 70, I thought that was really conservative. But now at almost 80, 50-50 is considered to be aggressive, but I'm still comfortable there. So, you know, kind of trying to decide what I don't want you to do is to become a market timer and start fixing that fixed income percentage based on how you feel. I want you to automate this whole thing as best you can. And if you're a big saver, like so many of the people, I was really impressed by the rate of saving amongst the white coat investor people there. I wasn't always as excited about the asset allocation. Now, if you can put that great saving attitude together with an automated way to take advantage of all the great equity asset classes, I think that will be absolutely wonderful. Next question. On slide 29, you showed the average 40-year returns for a bunch of different kinds of stocks, including both large and small value. There is about a 3% a year better return for the small cap value. You recommend one portfolio that includes both large and small value, and why not just own small cap value as they appear to go up and down together? Well, I would encourage, in fact, I'm going to make a note to make sure that we put a link in here to a what we call a quilt chart where you can see how large cap value did and small cap value did 1 year at a time. And you're going to be surprised there were a lot of years that large cap value did better. But yes, over the long term, because we know that over the long term, large cap value compounded, if we look at since 1928, at about 11.2, and the small cap value 2% higher. And I've already made the point loud and clear, every half a percent is a life changer, if not for your life, for somebody who survives you. So I think the combination for a young person, if they wanted to be all small for the first 20 years. And I mentioned 20 years because there's never been a 20-year period that small cap value didn't beat the S&P 500, which would be the other end of the spectrum, is to go more conservatively to the S&P 500 or some combination. But if we look at the last 52 years, the combination of the S&P 500 and small cap value at 12.7 versus about 14% for small cap value on its own. But I think you ought to figure out a way to start cooling your jets. I don't mean with fixed income, but probably between age 40 and 65 or whatever, you want to start some sort of an automated way to start adding the large cap value, or maybe even at age 40, you go to the four fund strategy. But don't start adding any fixed income till you're 50. I mean, this is why having an advisor who can kind of walk through this with you is helpful. One of my challenges is finding advisors who know my work, if in fact you're trying to use my work to help you figure out what to do. Take a look at that quilt chart. It's amazing. That's a Darryl Balls piece of work. He's our director of analytics. And not only do I like his analytics, but I love the way he will put stuff together to make it effective as a teacher. And my last question for today, what would you recommend for someone within 5 to 7 years? I love that question because it takes me back to when I would sit with people who were meeting. They never paid anything for that hour and a half meeting. And they sat through a 3 to 6 hour workshop And then I'd talk to anybody. Didn't matter if they had any money at all. Happy to give them some advice. And if they happened to end up being a client someday, that was wonderful. If not, I hope that my advice would help them do better. And many of those people were within 5 to 7 years. And I can remember so vividly a couple of school teachers out of Oregon who came to sit down with me, and they were interested in retiring now. And I looked at where they were and how much they had and all, and I said, well, I don't understand. You know, I'm worried for you. I don't think you have enough money to retire. And I think you ought to keep working for another 5 years, 3 to 5 years. I said, by the way, why are you wanting to retire now? And I always think of teachers as kind of kind, gentle people, or else really gruff. Well, these were nice people, but they said there are three things they don't like about teaching anymore. One are the students, two, the other teachers, and three, the principal. So I said, well, I'm a great believer in affirmations, and I think we need to sit here and make some affirmations that make you believe that you need to find a way to deal with these problems, because you need to work longer. And this is the part about being an advisor that is so much fun, is you can help people who aren't necessarily great with numbers and kind of look at themselves and their feelings, because it is so much about feelings. So when you're 5 to 7 years away from when you want to retire, I often want to find out if you already have enough money. Maybe you're 5 to 7 years away because what you want to do is be able to sign up for some sort of medical care. You qualify for some sort of insurance that will be cheaper, or maybe it's because you have another career in mind that actually is going to make you some money. But the question is, do you have enough right now? Could you retire right now? And if you do, why haven't you retired? Those are interesting answers often. But the other is, if you have enough and you do work another 5 or 7 years, really, should you continue to take the high risk that you're taking right now? Because you're taking the risk of an accumulator, typically, that's what we see, rather than somebody in distribution. So there are a lot of questions to be asked. This is the beauty of having a good hourly. I really am a big fan of hourly investment advisors, where they're just you want to look at a particular problem. What should I be doing now? I want to retire in 5 years. Well, it may be that what we got to determine is what your asset allocation should be in 5 to 7 years, and let's figure out how to get there. And maybe you'll continue to be a little more aggressive than you need to be, but if the gods shine on you and produce some really great returns quickly, does that mean then that the asset allocation transition will be a little faster towards retirement, even though you're not quite there? I do know this, that there is a huge advantage if you find a strategy that you trust. So if right now your portfolio is something that you're not really trusting, and you're for sure not sure you're going to trust it 5 to 7 years from now, just because you got a sense of anxiety about it doing what it needs to do for you. And it may even be that somebody like me gets up and says you should be in index funds with low expenses and massive diversification, and that's not what you have. So there may be a whole bunch of things that need to be fixed in this next 5 to 7 years, not just about asset allocation, but the way that you built your portfolio, so that when you do retire and you cannot fall back on that next paycheck, that you have a sense of confidence. It's all emotional stuff. And for many of us, the reason I'm so confident is we way oversaved. I didn't retire until I had multiples of what I needed. So if the market does bad things to me early in my retirement, that's okay because I have more than I need. Those kinds of discussions need to be had. And I hope in that 5 to 7 years, you find that combination. One of the reasons that we produce the tables that we do, the fine-tuning tables, the distribution tables, the accumulation tables, all of these different tables, variable, flexible distributions, fixed distributions, inflation-adjusted, not inflation-adjusted. The reason we develop all this stuff is so that you can go back and kind of pretend, what if I retired right before a big market decline? What would have happened to me? We can show you from the past what would have happened to you. And with our calculator that's free, you can even say, okay, I'd like to see over the next 30 years. And I see here that from 1999, that it was a pretty good time overall. But what if I retired in 1970 and made 2% less per year with my retirement? What would that have done? So you can test kind of how things hold up during bad times. So I hope some of that helps. I got to say, I love the dinners. I had a chance to sit with people and chat. I love the job that Jim and Katie are doing to educate all of you. As I think you know, I consider the white coat investor community to be made up of truth tellers. I can also tell you there are things that people do invest in within the community that I just don't choose to go there in my life because I'm too conservative and because I like one-day liquidity. But I think as an organization, it's just a tremendous work. And I am so happy that I had the opportunity to spend a few days with you all. And it is my understanding that they don't invite people back normally in consecutive years. So I'm hoping in a couple of years I get invited back and we'll have a chance to talk with you again. In the meantime, I hope you will tell your friends about our work. I am this next week going to be doing, because of one of the nice doctors there at the conference, has set up a conversation I'm going to have with some 15 of her fellow female physicians, and I'm going to give them a little of the work that I did there with you. They're not going to put up with me for 2 hours, unfortunately, but I'll do what I can, and it's what I do with a lot of my time. Let me know how I can help. All the best.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.